Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 74 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 828. Okay, we've completed the preface paper, if you will, of this first set on Adam and Eve proper. And so now we're ready, as the title says, to get immediately to the issue at hand. I don't think we really have to say too much besides that. Remember that when they're calling them Adam and Eve, they're calling material sons and daughters that go to worlds Adams and Eves, because we have a mythology that ties back to these two real individuals, and in those stories they're called Adam and Eve. In terms of their Hebrew sense, they have a basic sense of sort of being the archetypes. And remember how we talked about when they coined the names Andon and Fanta, that in a way they're sort of playing off of those names Adam and Eve to give us two similar names, indicative of. The archetype man and the archetype woman. Fanta and Eve both having that sense of being the source of life. We always have to keep that in mind, that the book is not disclosing language that's used on high any way. However, as we get in a little ways tonight, we'll come upon a proper name that gives us a little interesting tidbit about another famous name that we have in the Bible. So just a little tease. Let's go ahead and get started here.
Paper 74, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve arrived on Urantia from the year AD 1934, 37,848 years ago. It was in mid-season when the garden was in the height of bloom that they arrived. At high noon and unannounced, the two seraphic transports, accompanied by the Gerasim personnel entrusted with the transportation of the biologic uplifters to Urantia, settled slowly to the surface of the revolving planet in the vicinity of the Temple of the Universal Father. All the work of rematerializing the bodies of Adam and Eve was carried on within the precincts of this newly created shrine. And from the time of their arrival, 10 days passed before they were recreated in dual human form for presentation as the world's new rulers. They regained consciousness simultaneously. The material sons and daughters always serve together. It is the essence of their service at all times and in all places, never to be separated. They are designed to work in pairs. Seldom do they function alone.
I think before we get into some of the details in the first part of that paragraph, let's just note that even in this preface, they're ending that preface paragraph with a little reminder between the lines. It is the essence of their service at all times and in all places, never to be separated. Just, really, doubling, tripling, quadrupling down. They are designed to work in pairs. Seldom do they function alone. Yeah, we all know that that's where the problem developed. Angels in general have a pairing, but that pairing is a lot harder for us to understand. You know, in some aspects of it, it's involved in plugging into cosmic circuits and stuff like this. But in the case of Adam and Eve, all of us have a little bit of an understanding of the difference between men and women, and how we can work together in complementary fashion, and just take that all the way to a complete, precise expression, so that there's no overlap at all. They're totally dependent for any completeness, the one upon the other. They're two halves of a whole, very literally. And it's just a given that they're going to have blind spots if they try to do anything by themselves. It doesn't matter how much it will appear to be a complete picture to either of them. It's not. They have to know that, despite all appearances of the contrary, it is not a complete picture. I can't have a complete picture. I was designed that way, right? To only be one of two eyes, as it were. So the moment that is forgotten, off the rails everything goes in very short order.
Did they kind of get away with their know thyself?
we'll be talking about, how it is that something so fundamental to their nature, could have been so quickly forgotten. We'll get to that when we get into the story a little ways. But I want you to, I just wanted to emphasize that they didn't even leave the preface without, between the lines, pointing out the rest of the story, as it were. Okay, now, so wonderful little tidbit, and in the opening line there, they give us exactly to the year when they arrived. This allows us to be able to look at the mythology that we have and the history, the quasi history that we have with the Sumerians, things like that. We've got a very definitive date that we can pin some of that down, because you can tell when our histories, no matter how they might have been, how the actors might have changed in the mythology over time. You can, when you know the Adam and Eve story, you know that that mythology is actually hearkening back to Adam and Eve. It's a remembrance of Adam and Eve. And so knowing exactly when they arrived, you can see, how well were humans remembering this? How well were they keeping track of how long it's been since they arrived? It's a very purposeful, precise data point to help us to calibrate and properly interpret our history. And even when that history is kind of all fuzzed up in mythology.
When I first read this, and it was 38,000 years ago, approximately, it's like, that makes sense as to why people thought the first men and women were 38,000 years ago. I mean, that seems like a long time ago for us right now. Of course, you read the earlier parts, it's not that long, but I started here, in the Adam and Eve part, and I was like, wow, that's
quite
a long time ago.
And it's even a bigger number in terms of your kind of subjective sense of a long time ago. I mean, if you remember, those ancient peoples weren't keeping track in solar years. They were keeping track in 28-day months, right? So, that's a lot of 28-day months, right? In that subjective sense, see, it would be, way, way back in the mists of time, see? Very big number. Now, the specific, right? It's at this point that you can you know, instead of just talking about a number of years ago, you know, like we did all the time when we were going through the historical geology papers, you know, 200 million years ago, etc., you know, or whatever it is, you can actually start to talk about, well, what year BC are we talking about here? Okay, and yeah, you're talking about 35,915 BC. Okay, if you do the math there. Yeah, so 35,915. And when you think about that day, 35,915 BC, it's like, well, let's use the 915 years as kind of a little fudge. It's like, well, Adam and Eve would you give them a little time to kind of get settled in on this this rebellion world. You know, they can't really hit the ground running. So let's kind of just, you know, round it forward and say they would really gotten going on their program 35,000 BC. And that's why, you know, I often say, okay, normally they tell you 25,000 years later, and Adam and Eve, have the main aspect of what they come to do finished, you know, and then things are ready for the magisterial son to come. So from 35,000 BC, 25,000 years forward, you have 10,000 BC. You know, as I often point out, if everything had gone normally, you could, you know, estimate that in 10,000 BC, we would have had just practically an incomprehensible world, right? I mean, advanced science, you know, all one race, you know, the race is all blended and all uplifted and, you know, just an amazing place, right? I mean, amount of disease that would have been eliminated and just, you know, all those basic material scientific issues, the arts and sciences. Remember how there was that arts and science board back in the prince's, 10 different commissions? They would normally be very, you know, very much, working forward from the efforts of that board.
Of course, the prince took office, so we might not have been, in this world, might not have been the same as on a normal.
Yeah, yeah, right. Obviously, right. But that's why I said it's just an S. But if you just assume that they could still kind of get things done, you know, in the normal sort of span of time, might have been very, very different. But when all is said and done, it ended up being about the same amount of time. Let's just assume, 10,000 BC, right? It's just, so before our recorded history, right, which is, you know, somewhere in the 6,000 to 5,000 BC range is kind of when our recorded history is, you know, coming out of the mists. So it's just, you know, it kind of gives you that proper perspective on, just how different this world would be, you know, that we would have reached barely imaginable levels of evolutionary progress prior to when we think any sort of civilization began. Yeah, we're that sort of out of whack. All right, so anyway, so you got that little tidbit. And you'll see once we get done with the Adam and Eve proper and we, you know, go forward with the immediate consequences of their presence here, they kind of start at 35,000 BC and, move forward, just like I was saying. Okay, so you've got the usual, you know, arriving at noon, you know, the transports arriving at noon. Obviously, it's not just, you know, those two seraphic transports. Like they mentioned, you got all these other people, they're all being seraphically transported. You got this vast number of transport seraphim all landing at the same time. And, they even make a point of settled slowly to the surface of the revolving planet. Just that little subtle way of reminding you of the logistics of this, right? You know, you got a world that's going at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, right? You know, so, right. So they just, you know, come in, these transports that we're traveling at 3 times the speed of light almost, you know, they settle in slowly, synchronizing with the revolving planet, right there in the vicinity of the temple. And, you know, here we get an interesting little hearkening back to when we talked about material sons and daughters and Adam and Eve in general, back in paper 51, when they said here, and from the time of their arrival, 10 days passed before they were recreated in dual human form. Okay, the final paragraph of section 2, back there in 51, you don't have to turn there, but I'm just putting that out there for the record. You may recall they commented in general about that, how long it takes to rematerialize the material son and daughter on a planet. And they said there that this entire process takes 10 to 28 days of Urantia time. So this took 10. So it's the minimum time in the 10 to 28 ranges they told us about before. Which tells you a little something between the lines. You know, apparently it's the least effort required to translate whatever nature, you know, that they don't totally tell us that they have when they're on at the local system headquarters, you know, and then they're downstepped, you know, a little bit, and attuned to some of the specifics of the world they go to. So obviously from this, that is that's the most straightforward translation. You know, like you're left to speculate. It's like, well, 28 days, you know, almost 3 times longer. Would that be maybe like if they're going to a non-breather world? You know, and they're having, you know, there's a very significant, you know, transformation, you know, to match them up with a world like that, or one of those kind of very extreme worlds, you know, that are, you know, almost as extreme as a non-breather thing that they talk about. You know, maybe those are the ones that take longer. I mean, that's just a guess. I mean, maybe it's something I can't even imagine that leads to it. But at the very least, it seems like probably it's telling us that our world is, is in some way kind of as close to what they are like on Gerasim. And as I say that, that should remind you, oh yeah, remember when we went through all those different types of worlds and there, you know, every kind of variation like atmosphere or whatever, gravity, there was a spectrum. Remember how our planet was always in the middle, right, of those spectrums? That's probably the proper interpretation that you have, you know, if you downstep into the middle of the bell curve of the various, you know, ways that, you know, being is different on a world, you know, that takes the least amount of time, and the more you go to either end of the normal distribution, it would take longer. I mean, that's just a guess. And then the other little thing, once you put all that together is, so, yeah, they're coming to a world where it's a rebellion, and that's a shock, but at least kind of in the basic physicality, maybe it's not so different, and so they don't have to adjust to that. They can kind of pick up a little bit more the way they left off. You know, so that maybe should have helped a little bit for them to not feel so out of sorts. You know, you can imagine, must be quite a adjustment process. You go from, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of years, you've been this, you know, air breather on Gerasim, you know, and then you get sent to a non-breather world. Now you're suddenly, I mean, your total internal nature is different. You don't breathe air anymore or eat. You know, it'd be, you know, that'd be a huge transition. Anyway, so that's one of the things you can kind of just, you can pull out of between the lines and then reflecting on what they have here. Now, the other thing there was recreated in dual human form. You know, and you know, it's recreated. So remember, they don't have a dual form on Gerasim, right? They aren't using the tree of life, and you know, so they don't have that additional quote unquote circulatory system, or you know, various ways they kind of hint at this whole other aspect that's related to the energy of the tree and the energies that that allows them to be plugged into. Right, none of that is there in their original form. So they go from a single to a dual form when they're recreated. You know, we also, you know, don't know about things like, well, obviously you need to be a two-brainer here. You know, we don't, you know, we have no idea. Are they one, two, three-brainers, you know, on Gerasim? What kind, you know, how are material sons and daughters made in, you know, in regards like that? We don't know. But the big difference is that they're hinting at there is that it goes to this this more complicated internal structure with this other system that's related to the tree.
Well, at least we got one good thing going for us. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
Oh,
So far, yeah. Else, maybe. We're
on the average. We've got a break on that, though.
Yeah. Right. Yes, we may be a decimal world, but we're not, you know, off in a tail of, you know, of the various, you know, mortal bell curves. Yes.
You think we're like at the bloody limit? Deviant,
yeah, you can imagine there's some worlds that would be, you know, very, very, you know, out in the many sigma, you know, range. Okay, anyway, so you've got them being recreated, and remember this, you know, besides it, you know, don't just think of it as a kind of a horizontal shift of nature, right? There's a literal downstepping, you know, the fact that it's downstepped is why they need that additional internal structure we were just talking about. Plus, now when they procreate, they're not going to have immortal offspring. Right. They've been downstepped, so they procreate mortal offspring now, unlike all the offspring they left behind on Gerasim that we'll read about in a little bit here, you know, which were all immortal, naturally, you know, no tree of life. They're just naturally immortal. You know, not only are the ones here, you know, not immortal like that, but they're not even kind of quote-unquote immortal because they can use the tree of life. I mean, they don't pass on that additional stuff that is built into their Adam and Eve's bodies, right? And so that gives you all kinds of questions. Well, wow, how is that maintained if it's not part of the, you know, of their DNA that gets passed, you know, into their germ cells? It's like, well, there's probably a whole complexity that life carriers have to build into the whole bit of, you know, how they produce germ cells, you know, in some sort of a limited way. I mean, that kind of is inherent in the fact that they're not passing on immortality, you know. So there's, you can just think about all of the details that the life carriers have to tend to, right, to make their bodies so that they are what they need to be. Yep.
Maybe not a whole lot, unlike all the deities they're going to have to attend to make Amarantra bodies, you know, in the resurrection centers. You know?
Yeah.
And so for these guys, you know, they're probably a little bit more conscious. They've been around for thousands of years. All of a sudden, they're in one body. They kind of get put in a transport and get down here, and they're in another form,
mm-hmm,
with the same mind and the same, you know, thought or memories and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
that could be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one thing that
used to,
the one thing that they aren't changing like we will. I mean, they had adjutant mind there, and they do when they get here. You know, we have adjutant mind now, but we won't have adjutant mind in the first mansion world. We'll have Mirage mind. You know, so that's a bigger transition for us. You know, not to mention, as we always point out, the self that's talking to you right now is not resurrected. This adjutant mindal self that's talking to you right now, it's that other already Mirage self, the one that's seated on my soul, that's going to get resurrected up there. So in terms of that self, right? I mean, you know, you don't have, you know, it goes from mirage of mind to mirage of mind, just like they go from agitated mind to agitated mind. But, you know, if we think about the difference between us there and us here that we're conscious of, right, there is that contrast. You'll have a fundamentally different way that you think there because you'll have a different kind of mind. Yep.
But the self that becomes selfhood does get resurrected.
Yeah, I mean, there's a...
So part of our talking selves do become selfhood.
Right, I mean, yeah, the very fact that there can be another self that gets resurrected there than the one that's talking to you right now, and yet I'm still going to say it's me, must mean there's something that links the two together. There's some sort of higher aspect of my agitated self that is the same in that Maranja self, the selfhood, if you will, right? Now, as the revelators decide to use that term, you know, to indicate that they're that you have this red thread of continuity, the selfhood that that flows through all of the selves, not just this one and the next one, but all the selves after that you'll have, especially those first totally disjoint ones on the mansion worlds, right? That there's a commonality of selfness that they call our selfhood, yeah. Well, and that it's your personality is actually identifying with that selfhood more technically than it is with the self. See, because this personality comes from eternity, it can only identify with a finite phenomenon that is the equivalent of that which is of eternity, that thread of supremacy. You know, from a finite point of view, supremacy is like absoluteness and eternity. So it's that changeless red thread of supremacy that was initially circuited in you by grace that the personality can identify with. It can't identify with something that is innately fluctuating and temporal. I mean, it's this changeless fact. So it has to identify with something that's essentially like it.
There's a boundary relationship.
Right. Yeah. You know that there's the essence of commonality between the two. Yeah. Okay. So they get these bodies. You know. Well, I mean, of course, it's not like the prince's staff. You know, where you. Or they build a body, and then the Marantia being kind of gets combined with that body. They've been put in a temporary Marantia energy state, and then that energy is modified back into material energy with these new specs. Okay. Let's see. They both say they fire them up simultaneously. They regain consciousness simultaneously. Again, just pointing to how they are really two sides of one fact, right? I mean, yeah, they appear to be two, but they're really one. See,
of all the times they were together, that was one of them when they first booted up.
Yep,
right. Could be not together.
They can't be anything but simultaneous in that regard. And that's that leads into that final statement that we already talked about. Okay, so all of us can only imagine what it would be like to have been there live, as one of these ancient humans. You know, and then suddenly there's these two majestic creatures that seem an awful lot like you, but very fancy, very impressive. It's going to make a big impact. All that doubting and stuff that Van and Amnon were fighting with, remember? It's like, you know, everyone's like, oh, you're just, this is a fairy tale. I don't believe in your story anymore. I'm going to go, you know, go away. And he was having a hard time keeping them together. It's like, all that's put to an end now. And see, I told you so, so Van and Amnon say. Okay, so before they go on with that story I was just hinting at, you know, what about what they're leaving behind? They give us a little bit of specificity, like that general story they told us about with all of the material sons and daughters and Adam and Eve. What about our particular pair?
Section 1, Adam and Eve on Gerasim. The planetary Adam and Eve of Urantia were members of the senior corps of material sons on Gerasim, being jointly number 14,311. They belonged to the third physical series and were a little more than 8 feet in height.
Okay, so there's that. Let's take that last little bit again, right? That's another tidbit you may remember in the general story back there in 51. It's in the third paragraph of section 1 in paper 51, where they say, material sons vary in height from 8 to 10 feet. Okay, so here they're a little more than 8. You know, and you're immediately thinking, well, is that why they're the third physical series? Is that in order of height or, you know, similar things? Maybe the first or the tallest and the third or the shortest. You know, they just let you speculate on that one. But they are, nonetheless, you know, they've been around for a long time, so they're part of the senior core, and they've gone through all kinds of experiential advancement and what have you. You know, and they're even numbered as a pair, again, as if they were just one individual.
And your height could have to do with the atmosphere.
Now, I was just going to get to this. Now, well, I mean, the gravity would be, you know, that whole issue of them being downstepped a little bit, you know, to match up. Here you notice that it's like, well, okay, it doesn't look like their height was literally downstepped. I mean, if they went to a world where all the creatures were 4 foot tall, okay, they wouldn't be 8 foot, right? They'd get downstepped. But see, again, remember, we were recognizing that this was, they didn't have to do a very big transition. It took the shortest amount of time to rematerialize them.
So people were shorter than they are now, right?
Well, yes and no. I'm just about to get to that. So when you see them saying that they were a little more than 8 feet, it's like, well, okay, it doesn't look like their height was changed at all. It's like, well, aren't the humans here a little bit shorter? Yes and no. Okay. First of all, right, the Adam and Eve are not supposed to directly mate. Right? It's their children, and they're going to be downstepped another notch again to match up more precisely. But you go, yeah, but, you know, you, like I said, if everyone was 4 foot, they probably wouldn't, you know, have, that would be just like too stark to have them be 8 foot. But remember, you know, a little more than 8 feet, they're not the tallest humans on the planet. Mm-hmm. Right? On our planet, we have giant strange and the orange and green man. Or they can be 9 foot tall. Okay? So like I said, yes and no about the height thing. I mean, they really just fit right in, keeping them the same height as they were on Gerasim. So again, it speaks to that. It took 10 days, the closeness of the translation.
Some fine detective work, Chris.
it's always fruitful, you know, if you just spend a little time putting pieces together like that and think about it, you know, there's a number of things they don't tell you because they shouldn't have to, right? They only tell you something if there's no way, even with great effort, you can produce that yourself. Right? Everything else, right, you have to produce yourself. This is not a sacred text. It doesn't contain everything that you need, right? It's the minimum that you need, actually, and you need a lot more. I mean, as a first rough thought, you should think of it as half of what you need, and then it's up to you to wisely, integrously, truthfully generate the other half of the picture, right? Like I always indicate with this, hemispheres, right? They're giving you the upper hemisphere. You have to generate the human philosophy, the lower hemisphere. That the part that you can do, you must do, or you don't have a complete picture.
You know what happens if you're not wholehearted.
Right, again, see? And just to appreciate that the Urantia book, you know, is just half the heart that you're looking for. Half the personal living philosophy that you're looking for, right? It's the cosmic framework, but you've got to fill in the bottom-up details, okay? And so that's why I often, I've said this many times, that's why I often do these little asides and kind of step you through a little bit of reflective thinking and then some deductive reasoning, right, that can help you to flesh out more of the picture. And it often is like Chris was just noticing there. It's like, oh, that's cool. That, you know, you feel like you really have a living relationship to what's going on when you've put a few pieces together like that. It'll put your mind in the frame where you'll be able to recognize the truth. When you have that living feeling about the text you're engaging. It isn't just dead words on the page. All right, way down the road, hundreds of years from now, there'll probably be people that can actually think about, 14,311, huh? Right, there's probably something there even, but I mean, I don't know what it is. All right, anything else there? Let's see, okay, well, what else did I say here?
At the time Adam was chosen to come to Urantia, he was employed with his mate in the trial and testing physical laboratories of Gerasim. For more than 15,000 years, they had been directors of the Division of Experimental Energy as applied to the modification of living forms. Long before this, they had been teachers in the citizenship schools for new arrivals on Gerasim. And all this should be borne in mind in connection with the narration of their subsequent conduct on Urantia.
So the first thing there is just a little reminder, you know, the degree to which you can call Gerasim heaven, right, in kind of an old mythological way of heaven and earth, you know, in our stories. Heaven doesn't sound like a fluffy cloud where you go to play. My goodness, they were what? They were directors of the Division of Experimental Energy as applied to the modification of living forms. That sounds pretty technical, right? I mean, in other words, you can't even imagine what kind of advanced physicists they are, okay? And just how advanced of a physicist you'll be in relatively short order. Yeah, right. I was just going to say, once you have a little bit better mind and a better education system, you'll be able to go places you never imagined you could go in having both an inner life and an outer life, both a religion and a science that will come together in a super additive consequence of a cosmic consciousness. So that's kind of one of the things between the lines is, again, it's like, well, it seems like Adam and Eve are coming to this rebellion world. They've got a tough job, but, they're solid. I mean, think about how solid their cosmic consciousness must be. We're obviously building up to, but... Right? I mean, all this, it seems like is, it should go well, despite the difficulties, and it doesn't. They're talking about they've been doing that for the last, before they came, the last 15,000 years. And of course, long before that, I mean, like, who knows how many hundreds of thousands of years old or whatever they are. I mean, they go way, way back somewhere. You know, they could be millions of years old for all we know. You know, long before they had been teachers in the citizenship schools. That one reminds you, citizenship schools. Remember, we were just reading about civilization and getting up to statehood and how that means you finally get to the concept of citizens, right? There's statehood on high, right? Cosmic citizens isn't just a fun expression, okay? No, we're talking about what we mean by, or should mean by, citizens, and how, again, anyone whose rationalization scheme is drifting away from thinking citizenship is some sort of important thing that we should be concerned about, right? They're rotating their mind 180 degrees from the cosmos. Right? When citizenship disappears from relevancy in your mind, you know you've rotated 180 degrees away from truth, away from the cosmos. It's like, wow, I know a lot of people that are in that state. Yeah, there's this book in my lap. There's this emergency situation. Yeah, again, it all fits together.
It depends on how you look at it, because the book also talks about being citizens of the universe as well as citizens of, let's say, your country and stuff like that. So
that's what I'm trying to stress, is that citizen of the universe is not just a wonderful metaphor or something, you know, a creature of the universe. No, you're a citizen, right, of a universe with an executive branch and a legislative branch and a judicial branch, and right. I mean, you are a literal citizen of a cosmic state. See? you know, a cosmic state that's not just a state of mind, it's a literal state with a government and bureaucrats, you know, and the whole works. Okay? And political boundaries and
duties within that.
Right. You have massive duties, right? I mean, you think your duties might be huge as a, you know, as a responsible citizen of a country on this planet, a state on this planet. I mean, think of the duties when you're at, say, the constellation level of citizenship, right? There's going to be huge duties, right? That are inescapably part of that.
You want me to do that? Yeah. Really, I'm supposed to involve
right. We've talked about that a lot. It's that's why I brought up the fluffy clouds. See, I mean, it's an opportunity to just remind you again to challenge yourself to not think of the old notions of going to heaven, you know, and everything just goes fuzzy. You know, you can lay around all day and eat Cheetos off your belly, you know, and watch TV. That's not what heaven is like, right? The higher you go, the more rigorous it gets.
I think
right.
There's Cheetos anywhere up there.
All right. You get my point.
They have all the trappings.
Let's see.
Why the last sentence when it says you'd be born in mind? Well,
I've already been kind of doing that. See, I've been pointing out, it's like, man, all of this integrity.
Obviously, that way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some specific things like, you know, how much they know about, you know, living forms and stuff. You know, that comes up here shortly, you know, a couple sections from now. But the general thing is, right, to make sure that you don't rationalize their default away. It's like, well, you know, of course you can't expect people like that to not default. I mean, they're such limited individuals. No. It's like, that's not your, there's no easy out like that. Right? Their default is in just complete defiance of all of this. Right? And so you have to penetrate. Well, how could they default then?
Millennia of this operating together thing.
Right.
They just, you know.
Right. How could this be? Right. You know, they want to make sure that this is very similar to our quizzical, you know, expressions when we try to figure out how a Lennon deck like Lucifer could possibly go to rebellion, right? It's very important to face that fact of it appears to be someone that couldn't, and yet they did. And so why? And if you can figure out why, then you can understand how you could follow the same path unwittingly.
And you didn't have the training.
Right. Yeah. Because it doesn't have anything to do with that training, no training. Yeah. It's something different. Yeah. Right? It's just like all of the incredibly genetically brilliant minds, you know, with several PhDs on this planet who are ignorant as can be. Right? It doesn't matter how brilliant their mind is and how much education they have. Right? They think the emperor has clothes on. Okay? How can that be? How can that well-trained, brilliant person think like that? There's this blind spot. Doug first.
Wouldn't they take it into consideration that there could be a default and then they have a kind of backup plan by not finding the right...
Sure, person? Yeah, there's always a backup plan. Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, we talked about that. You know, remember the neighboring planet paper? They're a both rebellion and default world as well. There's a high probability that an Adam and Eve will default. I'm sure, going to a rebellion world. You know, one can even wonder: is it ever not happen? I mean, you know, we'll see here in a second. They're just about to read that. How much they tried to make sure that they're trying to stack the deck as much as possible against that possibility, okay? Because everyone on high knows how difficult this is going to be. Yeah. So
kind of speaks to the difference between knowledge and wisdom, because they were obviously had thousands of years to accumulate knowledge,
mm-hmm.
but ideal conditions which they experience don't always contribute to the wisdom necessary to deal with less than ideal conditions.
What's the inescapable prerequisite for wisdom?
Tribulation.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. As we're about to read, they went through the rebellion, but, okay, that was 2 years, right, on Gerasim. A 2-year issue, right? All right, I mean, yeah, that whole issue. How much tribulation have you experienced? So how much wisdom can you even possibly have acquired? Right? Lots and lots of learning, but... not in the school of hard knocks. Right. Okay. All right, keep going.
When the proclamation was issued, calling for volunteers for the mission of Adamic Adventure on Urantia, the entire senior corps of material sons and daughters volunteered. The Melchizedek examiners, with the approval of Laniforge and the Most Highs of Edentia, finally selected the Adam and Eve, who subsequently came to function as the biologic uplifters of Urantia.
Okay, so did they default because, well, you know, there were only three sets to pick from, and no, every single member of the senior corps, right? Okay, they were the creme de la creme, right?
Maybe you're right. Maybe a lot of them do default.
The best that Gerasim had to offer, specific to this situation,
yeah.
Right? You know, same way with the neighboring planet where that Adam and Eve defaulted. Those would have been out of all, you know, we would have the exact same story, and out of all of them, the best for that world were selected, and they still defaulted.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe in the back of Melchizedek's mind, or not even in the back, they were thinking we should have someone default because it's going to add this whole thing to the Supreme. I don't know. Maybe we should pick someone who has that little
kernel. Now, again, you know, the conspiracy is not in the those who pick, right? The conspiracy is in the evolutionary process, you know, as it were. You know, it's in the nature of the whole. But you know, they wouldn't have been picking them to fail. All right. But it may just be mostly inescapable that that when you have a rebellion, in order to eventually have everything come out as it should, it needs to be a default world as well. I think you can safely say that, you know, from what they tell you in other places, that a rebellion world, it wouldn't be necessary for the Adam and Eve to also rebel. But it might often be necessary for them to default, you know, in the grand scheme of things. Right? But they're not going to, you know, go there and throw the fight. You know, they gave it their best. Okay. All right. Using the throw the fight analogy. These analogies just pop into my head. I apologize.
You know, they did their utmost. This was just supposed to go a certain way. You know, every detail, they looked after it like the mother hen that they are.
Yeah. I mean, we all know how they are with dotting I's and crossing T's on high. I mean, you know, it's just, they're crazy from our perspective in that regard. I mean, you know, it has to go through so many different, you know, committees and, you know, modes of approval and whatnot, you know.
So. They'd be in default or something if they were party to that.
So yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if they were consciously, you know, tweaking things to the negative, right, they would be in rebellion. This is Lana Forge, right? The unshakable, right? And the Most Highs, which were innately so.
They've had enough go wrong already.
So anyway, you know, again, see, just, you know, we're spending a little time on a simple factual paragraph like that. There's a lot more than just fact there, see? You know, when you just reflect on it a little bit. All right, keep going.
Adam and Eve had remained loyal to Michael during the Lucifer Rebellion. Nevertheless, the pair were called before the system sovereign and his entire cabinet for examination and instruction. The details of Urantia affairs were fully presented. They were exhaustively instructed as to the plans to be pursued in accepting the responsibilities of rulership on such a strife-torn world. They were put under joint oaths of allegiance to the Most Highs of Edentia and to Michael of Salvington, and they were duly advised to regard themselves as subject to the Urantia Corps of Melchizedek Receivers until that governing body should see fit to relinquish rule on the world of their assignment.
So, stressing how humble they're expected to be and how sobered by the facts they're expected to be. Literally to the point of, it's like, seriously? We went through the rebellion. No, raise your right hand. I do solemnly swear, right, allegiance to the Most Highs of Edentia, to Michael of Nebadon. Those in charge are doing their utmost to try to mitigate every possible avenue of unraveling, right? To try to button it down as much as they can. Get them to very consciously bring their will into play, consecrate themselves toward this with a lot of precision.
You think they told them that, you know, Caligasu was going to try and screw them up and everything like that?
Yeah,
this is the ways he might do it. And
accepting the responsibilities of rulership on such a strife-torn world, that would have been that whole lecture about just how difficult this is going to be with Caligastia, you know, yeah, waving his hands in your face all the time, trying to you know, get you to lose your train of thought. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, they would have been given all of that. You know, they probably even, you know, their education systems are very advanced. There's probably kind of even simulation things they can, you know, they can go through, right? And try to work this out, try to train their mind, you know, to have a kind of a habitual response the way it should to that sort of negative assault.
Training.
Yeah.
My hour has not come.
But nonetheless, we all know, even with all of this preparation. You know, and you see that it's very much in the Melchizedek's hands, even from the perspective of those above them, how long the Melchizedek's hang on. See, I mean, Adam and Eve arrive, Melchizedek's don't have to leave immediately. They could say, well, no, we'll keep the receivership for the first 10,000 years, and you'll work under us. You know, or they could say, all right, we're out of here today. I mean, it's totally in the Melchizedek's hands about how long they think it's appropriate before they totally hand it over to Adam and Eve.
What did they say?
Well, we'll get to that in here in a little bit. They'll tell us just how long it was. But I was just pointing out, see, they're hinting at there's this variable there. Okay, what else do they say?
This Gerasim pair left behind them on the capital of Satania and elsewhere 100 offspring, 50 sons and 50 daughters, magnificent creatures who had escaped the pitfalls of progression and who were all in commission as faithful stewards of universe trust at the time of their parents' departure for Urantia. And they were all present in the beautiful temple of the material sons, attendant upon the farewell exercises associated with the last ceremonies of the bestowal acceptance. These children accompanied their parents to the dematerialization headquarters of their order and were the last to bid them farewell in divine speed as they fell asleep in the personality lapse of consciousness which precedes the preparation for seraphic transport. The children spent some time together at the family rendezvous, rejoicing that their parents were soon to become the visible heads, in reality the sole rulers, of planet 606 in the system of Satania.
Okay, so besides the interesting details about their family on Gerasim, you know, did you see what they were trying to, you know, say between the lines about what we've been talking about? Again, not just Adam and Eve stayed integrous through the Lucifer rebellion 200,000 years ago, but all their children. Okay? All right, so, I mean, they're, you know, there's just a genetic integrity, perhaps, that speaks to, that they're passing on to their children, not to mention a parenting integrity. I mean, they've got to become the parents of all the mortals on this world when they come here, right? They've got to parent everyone forward. You know, they obviously have a very rock-solid family. All the children were there participating, you know. They don't have some rogue kid. It's like, I'm not going to go to mom and dad's send-off. I mean, you know. No kids like that. They're all totally together as a fantastic family. Magnificent creatures, their children are described as. Right?
But they're probably grown-up children.
Sure, yeah. Sure, but, yeah.
I mean, are their kids kind of emancipated from that pair-minded functionality? Do they... have to, you know, I mean, they seem like if they're going to pair up with mortals, they would kind of...
Sure, I mean, you know...
individual.
You know, once those kids were past 20 years old, right, I mean, you know, they're definitely moving on their own. You know, and again, like you were just saying, I mean, some of these kids might be millions of years old, right? We don't know how old some of these children are. We don't know how old Adam and Eve are. Now, the one thing we do notice there is how... rigorously, obviously, the procreation is regulated amongst the material sons and daughters. I mean, you know, even if they've only been living for hundreds of thousands of years, okay, they only have 100 kids. Right, so that, you know, this is all very controlled. You know, when material sons and daughters have kids, obviously, and it has all this pattern to it. You know, there's 100, okay, 50 males, 50 females. I mean, it's obviously all very ordered and whatnot. You see that between the lines as well. So you know, they're used to. So besides the immediacy of that fact is, again, that would speak to how used to Adam and Eve are to a regimen, to living for hundreds of thousands of years in a very precise regimen, and none of this, well, I don't know, I just feel like procreating today. Who cares if they told us not to do it? Let's just go for it. No, not once, ever, right? Never did they, you know, go astray from the whole very clamped down regime that they've lived in all their lives. So, again, it all speaks to this should go well. They should be able to stick to the plan. They've been sticking to plans all their existence.
Yep. Also, ceremonies and family celebrations and that kind of thing is important. Like, I love that we have that.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, between the lines of that, again, remember, they're not that different from us. They have agitated mind just like we do. See, we can very much understand, you know, or imagine a lot of the culture of the material sons and daughters, right? Because it's basically, you know, like us. And you see that right there, that, you know, not including, you know, how they, after mom and dad left, you know, the children spent some time together at the family rendezvous. You know, it's almost like, you know, when a relative dies and the family is all together, right? The family rendezvous, right? They have that whole sensibility about themselves just like we do. All right, and, you know, and they're all very excited about this. Like, yeah. Mom and dad are going to be the sole rulers. This is really a fantastic opportunity. So, you know, how, you know, all the kids are really supportive, mom and dad. They would think of how much positive feedback that mom and dad would have gotten from the kids, you know, and kind of gotten them ready to take on this challenge, the responsibility of it. So, you know, like I said, you can just go on and on and on and on. It's almost endless. Yeah. How appropriate this should have been. Okay? How well this should have gone, so it appears. Okay, last little bit.
And thus did Adam and Eve leave Gerizim amidst the acclaim and well-wishing of its citizens. They went forth to their new responsibilities, adequately equipped and fully instructed concerning every duty and danger to be encountered on your rancho.
See, there it is. So not just the family, right, but everyone on Gerizim amidst the acclaim and well-wishing of its citizens. Oh, there's the citizens again. So you remember your Gerizim citizens. But see, and like I said, you know, just the way that sentence started out, and thus, like we've been stressing, thus, as we've been stressing, right, everything is in place. You know, they're adequately equipped and fully instructed concerning every duty and danger.
That's what I was asking.
Right. Every duty. I mean, they've gone over everything exhaustively. Right.
So they would have been briefed on, you know, the forces there are going to try to cleave you guys apart. Mm-hmm. Get you kind of sequestered,
right,
away from each other.
Right. They would even, you know, I'm sure they would have been instructed on tactics, right, that probably would be, because remember, this is not the first rodeo of Adam and Eve going to a rebellion world. I mean, you know, those on high have seen this play out many times.
They were on the holodeck.
I mean, there's probably, you know, other rebel worlds, right, in our local system that got Adam and Eve before them. Yeah. I mean, maybe even the neighboring planet. Maybe their Adam and Eve came a little bit before this one. Right? You know, so they would have seen how it played out there. Our Adam and Eve would have seen it, you know, not to mention their superiors. Yeah. There would have been all of this. Yeah. But, yeah. So you can see when all is said and done, the way they said that, every duty, every day, they're trying to get it, like I said, so that you don't have any way that you can rationalize their default away the way you're going to tend to want to rationalize it away. Right? It's something more profound, right, than what you initially would think. Well, it's some educational deficit, or it's some, right, or what? No, it's none of those things. What is it? Okay, so meanwhile, back to the end of the 10 days of them getting rematerialized. How does this play out? Are they going to tell us the story here on the planet?
Section 2, Arrival of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve fell asleep on Gerizim, and when they awakened in the Father's temple on Urantia, in the presence of the mighty throng assembled to welcome them, they were face to face with two beings of whom they had heard much, Van and his faithful associate Amidon. These two heroes of the Caligastia succession were the first to welcome them in their new garden home.
Yeah. Besides just a wonderful little vignette there of the facts. See, again, I mean, who's the first people that engage them? These incredible examples that the whole universe of universes knows about. Who've stood firm for 150,000 years all by themselves. Right? I mean, you look at them and you're like, oh, well, if Van and Amidon can do it, I can do it.
And they're looking at you like, okay.
See, again, it just adds to the, it's like, man, I mean, you know, all the inspiration they have, appropriate inspiration, everything. Between the lines there, the mighty throng assembled. During those 10 days' time, a lot of people have, it's not like what's going on in the vicinity of the temple there, you know, where they're doing this rematerializing. I mean, I'm sure that the general mortals are not, allowed to see all of the science, this fancy stuff that's going on. You know, there's probably high-tech gear and all kinds of stuff, but everyone knows that there's something going on, right? At the very least, they can see an opaque curtain right, that's been set up or something, right?
Yeah.
There's everyone's astir. They know something's going on here. And Van and Amidon would have told him, yes, they've arrived, right? And they're getting prepared. Okay.
The tongue of Eden was an Andonic dialect as spoken by Amidon. Van and Amidon had markedly improved this language by creating a new alphabet of 24 letters, and they had hoped to see it become the tongue of Urantia as the Edenic culture would spread throughout the world. Adam and Eve had fully mastered this human dialect before they departed from Gerizim, so that this son of Andon heard the exalted ruler of his world address him in his own tongue.
Yeah, so pretty cool thing for Amidon there. And you notice that they made a point of calling him this son of Andon, like I was hinting up front. You know, there's this kind of parallel in the coinage of Andon and Fanta to the words Adam and Eve. You've got, you also see that, Van and Amidon, they know all the complexities of all the races and all this sort of stuff, but they're thinking that eventually there's going to be one language on the planet, and it's going to be this language predicated on an Andonite dialect, the Andonite tongue. Which kind of gets you thinking about that whole pre-blended race kind of idea of, you know, having this pre-Sangic race, the Andonites, that, you see, in the way their mind is attuned to their nature, see, this is hinting at that there's the essence of that harmonized people of the future, you know, that will there will be a naturalness for that blended, upstepped race to speak a language predicated on kind of this rudimentary core or foundation of that blended people, this pre-blended people, these Andonites. Okay, so that seems to reinforce the appropriateness of thinking that way about the Andonites as a quote-unquote pre-blended race. You know, way down the road, we'll want to remind ourselves that the alphabet had 24 letters and how the Revelators play on that fact. That's several papers away yet, but that's a little tidbit to kind of stash in the back of your mind that there's 24 letters in this alphabet. Now, the other little thing is they'd fully mastered this dialect before they departed. Again, it reminds you of, like we were saying, how, you know, adjutant mind there, adjutant mind here. I mean, you know, there's this very straightforward commonality there. And the fact that they can, you know, engage at a very literal, material level a language like we do, because they're just material beings with adjutant mind, just like us. You know, it's much more understandable for us to think of them learning one of our languages than, you know, say a divine counselor is supposed to present his papers in English. You know, we've talked about that. There's some subtleties to thinking about, you know, in what way he's consciousizing it in English. He's consciousizing it at a very high, holistic level of quote-unquote English. But Adam and Eve, okay, I mean, they're right down in the trenches with us, right? I mean, so their relationship to a human language is just what you can imagine, right? All right, let's keep going.
And on that day, there was great excitement and joy throughout Eden as the runners went in great haste to the rendezvous of the carrier pigeons assembled from near and far, shouting, "Let loose the birds. Let them carry the word that the promised Son has come." Hundreds of believer settlements had faithfully, year after year, kept up the supply of these home-reared pigeons for just such an occasion.
I know. I mean, even the home-reared thing is like, wow, that's really getting... Right. But see, it's just to remind you just how dedicated these people were, you know, in all these little outlying posts.
It's funny because the pigeons and they tweeted,
right? Let's see, anything else there? Let's see. Well, just maybe, you know, just the specific hundreds of believer settlements. You know, we remember they gave us some hints before when Van and Amenon were going to set up the garden. You know, there are these, you know, settlements around that area of the world that Van and Amenon were overseeing. All right, go on.
As the news of Adam's arrival spread abroad, thousands of the nearby tribesmen accepted the teachings of Van and Amenon, while for months and months pilgrims continued to pour into Edom to welcome Adam and Eve and to do homage to their unseen father.
Yep, so we already... I hinted at that. You know, all of the doubting is okay. That whole bit of, remember, they were questioning Van's faith, quote unquote. And, nothing clears humans' minds of self-produced fog, you know, like something that you can literally walk up and shake hands with. And it's 8 foot tall, you know, and it glows in the dark. So it the vividness, right, of it punched through all of that fog. Like we were saying, you can just only imagine the line, right? I mean, the receiving line. Poor Adam and Eve, you know, but it had to spend a big chunk of their day every day. You know, nice to meet you. Your name is, you know, thousands and thousands of people, you know, wanting to tell them their name, where they're from, and give them their whole family history, and blah, blah, blah. It's all pretty fun. And it just, again, that adds to the fact that there's all this support, and they would get them, wow, there's all these people that are depending on us, you know, this, yeah, we need to definitely knuckle down and do this. I mean, you know, all these people, they're so earnest, they're so sincere, they're so wide-eyed and ready to do whatever we tell them to do. This, we can do this. All right.
Soon after their awakening, Adam and Eve were escorted to the formal reception on the great mound to the north of the temple. This natural hill had been enlarged and made ready for the installation of the world's new rulers. Here, at noon, the Urantia Reception Committee welcomed this son and daughter of the system of Satania. Amadon was chairman of this committee, which consisted of 12 members, embracing a representative of each of the 6 Sangic races. The acting chief of the Midwares, Annan, a loyal daughter and spokesman for the Noddites, Noah, the son of the architect and builder of the garden, and executive of his deceased father's plans, and the 2 resident life carriers.
I mean, the last one, remember, there's actually 14 life carriers that got permission to stay on here. They're talking about the 2 senior ones. There's 2 seniors and then 12. Assistants that are with them, but those are the 2 senior life carriers. There's the name. It's like Noah. Now, obviously, we're not talking about the Noah of legend with the ark, but it's the same name. So, in other words, okay, that's not a name that the Hebrews coined, in the not too distant past. That's a name that goes way back. Okay. That's an interesting little tidbit. The antiquity of that name, and it reminds you how in the Hebrew language there in the Near East you have. All those language would be incorporating this very ancient stuff from that region, going way, 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 way back. In the same way that, they tell you his name was Van. Oh, you mean like that lake in Turkey? Yeah, V-A-N, right? That's not some recent name. That's literally the name that goes all the way back to 500,000 years ago. So that's kind of fun, just knowing the kind of unexpected antiquity of, again, we look at things in our languages saying, we all think, well, that was generated sometime since the beginning of recorded history. Right? Can't be any older than about 6,000 BC. No. Might be very, very, very old. Some of those things in those languages. Let's see. And anything else there? Let's see. Remember you were asking about the architect. There must have been a quite sophisticated architect for the garden when they were talking about all the details, all the roads, and all this stuff. Yeah. See, there it is. Noah's the son of that master architect. Let's see. And they say the acting chief of the midwares. Remember, we only have primary midwares at this point. No secondary midwares. those haven't come into existence yet. All right. What else do they tell us here?
The next act was the delivery of the charge of planetary custody to Adam and Eve by the senior Melchizedek, chief of the Council of Receivership on Urantia. The material son and daughter took the oath of allegiance to the Most Highs of Norlaishadek and to Michael of Nebadon, and were proclaimed rulers of Urantia by Van, who thereby relinquished the titular authority which for over 150,000 years he had held by virtue of the action of the Melchizedek receivers.
Okay, so, I mean, can you kind of tell there, the Melchizedek receivers haven't totally let go, right? They're still the umbrella phenomenon here, the overarching fact. You know, and Van has been underneath them as the titular ruler of the world. So all you're doing is just swapping out Van, you know, and putting in Adam and Eve as, you know, no longer the titular rulers, but literally the rulers. But it's a rulership that's under their oversight still, to start with anyway, heresy. Now, the senior Melchizedek, right, they never explicitly tell you in the revelation of the 12 receivers, you know, which, you know, the senior one of those 12 who was in charge. But like I've pointed out, you know, it slowly dawns on you that a handful of the Melchizedeks involved in the revelation, they give, quote unquote, first names to, like Machaventa. And one of those is Mantusha. And, you know, you can eventually, as I've done, recognize the literalness of that name and go, wait a minute, that would imply, I think the only way that you can, that could be the literalness of his name is if he's the senior. I said, as I pointed out, I'm pretty sure this senior Melchizedek, that's Mantusha. The one who's is in charge of the second revelatory commission that's behind parts 2 and 3 of the book. You know, that commission, of that Nebadon commission, that's behind parts 2 and 3 of the book. You know, if you're, I won't go into it right now, but if you're interested, you can look in the etymology, and I'll look up what I say there about Mantusha. Let's see. The other interesting little tidbit there. Besides this, you know, just this general fact, like I was saying before, of the Melchizedeks keeping their oversight role, you know, and swapping out, you know. Swapping Adam and Eve in for, you know, Van as the quote unquote ruler under their oversight. Look at how we have the oath of allegiance again here. Only if you were really paying attention, you know, this is an interesting little tweak. See here, it's so that Mantusha, most likely, you know, the senior Melchizedek, you know, has him take an oath of allegiance to the Most Highs of Norlaishadek and to Michael of Nebadon. Look back there in section 1. How are those two described there? The Most Highs of Edentia and Michael of Salvington. Isn't that interesting? So that when on Gerasim, when you had Lanaforge, and having him take this oath, they're referred to, you know, the Most Highs and Michael are referred to relative to the headquarters world. But here, they're referred to as the domain name, right? The constellation or the local universe name. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's even that subtle little detail. So you're on a headquarters world, and you're referring to the leaders on the other headquarters worlds in that first one. Here, right, it's the Melchizedeks, right, that are, and they speak not as, well, I'm on a headquarters world, I'm going to refer to other guys on other headquarters worlds. No, we're on no headquarters world at all. We're within a domain, and we speak of them relative to that domain. You know, we're within Norlaishadech and we're within Nebadon. So just that's a fascinating little detail of just how the one administering the oath, you know, sees themselves relative to who, right, you know, the oath is directed to. That's how cool the book is. Just little details like that are just all over the place. Let's see here. What else do we have there? I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yep, keep going.
And Adam and Eve were invested with kingly robes on this occasion, the time of their formal induction into world rulership. Not all of the arts of Dalmatia had been lost to the world. Weaving was still practiced in the days of Eden.
Remember, I referred to that earlier. I see the arts of Dalmatia. Remember that the board of involved with arts and sciences? Right? They were the ones that taught weaving. And Van and Amidon, and she had kept that going, even though they weren't on that board. Right? They were trying to do all the different things, oversee all the different areas, you know, to some degree. So they had kept the weaving going, so you could have these very fancy kingly robes. Yeah. You know, as much incredible detail and complexity as went into the gardens, you can imagine these weren't just, you know, chunks of cloth with armholes cut in them, right? I mean, these were probably very fancy.
How fancy could they get?
I mean, well, remember, there was tons of precious stones and metals all over. You know, these things were probably encrusted with all kinds of precious stones and all very fancy. Let's see here. And just, you know, one little thing to kind of, you know, think of between the lines. You know, the way they're literally, you know, speaking of Adam and Eve as the rulers of the world. And it's just like I always kind of joke, hello, my name is Machaventa Melchizedek, and I'm the ruler of this world. You know, one day when he shows up, I mean, you know, that's literally, okay, I mean, that's what he will literally say, right? You know, he will be putting himself forward as the ruler of the world, not as the high priest or the, you know, the enlightener or, you know, no. The ruler of the world, period.
A buck stops.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And everyone is just going to have to deal with it, right? Anyone with, you know, delusions of conquering the world and being the world's ruler or something, no. Okay. That'll finally be settled, all those delusions of grandeur. And like I said, you know, like I've said many times, this might be put to the test. Oh, yeah, so you think you're the ruler? Well, let me launch a couple of nuclear weapons at you, you know. Maybe Vladimir Putin will want to be the ruler of the world and, you know, not take too kindly to that idea. You know, well, the master physical controllers will just, you know, make them disappear. All right?
Okay, let's get it over with. Things to do here.
Right? Yeah, and I mean, no, I'm the ruler of this world, period. Right? Period. All right. There's no way to usurp that. So that'll be a very interesting time. Okay.
Then was heard the archangel's proclamation, and the broadcast voice of Gabriel decreed the second judgment roll call of Urantia and the resurrection of the sleeping survivors of the second dispensation of grace and mercy on 606 of Satania. The dispensation of the prince has passed. The age of Adam, the third planetary epoch, opens amid scenes of simple grandeur. And the new rulers of Urantia start their reign under seemingly favorable conditions. Notwithstanding the worldwide confusion occasioned by lack of the cooperation of their predecessor in authority on the planet.
See, how many times have I stressed that? Under seemingly favorable conditions. Right? It's apparently favorable, but not really. Right? We know it's not really. We're about to see an exercise in the difference between appearance and reality.
Don't confuse the honeymoon.
Yeah. Okay, now, you know, I suspect there could be some confusion here. Right? Then was heard the archangel's proclamation, and the broadcast voice of Gabriel decreed. That's not here. Right? I mean, the first thing that should catch is like, wait a minute, broadcast voice of Gabriel. How could, I thought the circuits were cut. How could Gabriel's voice be broadcast here? I can't. Right? Right? That his voice is being broadcast to the first mansion world. The archangel is on the first mansion world. Right? I mean, you can flip it around, you know, go up towards the end of part four, and they talk about the next dispensational resurrection, right? And Gabriel is here, right? And they have to use the archangel circuit for the first time so he can send his voice to the first mansion world. Right? It's the first mansion world where you're hearing the archangel's proclamation and the broadcast voice of Gabriel. Adam and Eve and everyone here, there's not a whisper. It's dead silence here, right? None of that is being, you know, relayed like it normally would be to this world for everyone, you know, like the Adam and Eve to hear. Right, just crickets on this planet.
Yeah. That's where all the action's taking place, because that's where
right. Everyone's being resurrected. You know, the resurrection halls are on the first mansion. I mean, that's where all the action is. You know, the archangel is overseeing the resurrection there, not here. No one's being resurrected here. So, I mean, I'm stressing that because they're just about to, just, you know,
start to speak
to that, right, that issue. Right? It's all glorious on the first mansion world with trumpets blasting and blah, blah, blah. It's all exciting. Okay, here it's dead silent. Okay? No, none of the normal positive feedback for the Adam and Eve. Okay, so here we go.
Section 3. Adam and Eve learn about the planet. And now, after their formal installation, Adam and Eve became painfully aware of their planetary isolation. Silent were the familiar broadcasts, and absent were all the circuits of extraplanetary communication. Their Gerasim fellows had gone to worlds running along smoothly, with a well-established planetary prince and an experienced staff ready to receive them and competent to cooperate with them during their early experience on such worlds. But on Urantia, rebellion had changed everything. Here the planetary prince was very much present, and though shorn of most of his power to work evil, he was still able to make the task of Adam and Eve difficult and to some extent hazardous. It was a serious and disillusioned son and daughter of Gerasim who walked that night through the garden under the shining of the full moon, discussing plans for the next day.
Okay. They didn't make it 24 hours.
Disillusionment, right?
Not even 24 hours. See, right? I mean, they were awakened at noon. Not even 24 hours. And it's already creeping in. I mean, you're going, well, are you sure, Chris? It's like, well, okay, notice it started out, it said painfully aware. Yeah. Right, so in other words, it's getting down to, right down there on the first level of meaning, right? And the hitting them in the gut, anguish. And okay, I mean, on its surface, it's like, well, okay, it serious and disillusioned. So you think, okay, well, what they mean by disillusioned there then probably is just, well, an appropriate thing. They shouldn't have any false illusions about this, and to have those kind of cleared away and facing the facts, right? They should be doing that. They should be sobered. You know, they should be apart from illusions. They should be disillusioned in that sense. But we all know disillusioned also has that other sense to it. It's like, you know, yeah, but maybe not here. You're thinking, you know, maybe you're overplaying it. But, you know, I mean, you know, again, if the Revelators didn't want you to be kind of thinking about that in a more negative sense, right, they would have picked a different word. All right, and then they also said painfully there at the beginning. So you're already thinking, I'm guessing that that the seeds are already starting to sprout, right, of the default, and it hasn't even been 24 hours yet. And you can't help but, you know, we're about to go through day one, day two, day three. It's like, oh yeah, it's like that story in the beginning in Genesis 1, you know, the first day, second day. You can't help but notice what happens on the first day, you know, in the Bible story. Let there be light, right? And the light is separated from the darkness. Right? Adam and Eve on the first day see the separation between light and darkness. Right? And what they're seeing is internally, most significantly here, see? They haven't seen the darkness outside the wall and everything yet, right? I mean, not in that, you know, external world sense, right? But the dark and the light inside has already been separated, right? The light has become separated, and there's now this little bit of darkness within them, right? That's going to slowly kind of ooze, you know, into their pores over time.
The instruction Arnhai could not really prepare them for the experience.
Yeah.
And it, same with us. Like, you can have all the platitudes forever, mm-hmm. but where the rubber meets the road, then you find out who you are.
Yeah.
There's no way around it.
Yeah, and
water in the face here.
And the
all of us are just as vulnerable.
Yeah. Right, and you can already kind of see, you know. All that is like, well, it appears they've been given everything, okay, but they, you know, they're hinting at it right there. They became painfully aware of their planetary isolation, all right? You downstep them a little bit, all right? And so that the light can become separated more easily, as it were. And you take away the whole outer life support system. Right? You have to stand courageously and independently on your own 2 feet. Period. Yeah. Right? The binary sort of absolute, you know, was just too present, right? All the grace, see, kind of evaporated, right? And we've talked about that a lot. We all live, you know, in the midst of a lot of grace, right? We aren't forced to face the stark, absolute, binary, black and white of, you know, eternity oblivion, right? I mean, there's all this grace buffering between us and that, right? Right now, right? But we know they say that we should have courageous and independent cosmic thinking, right? That we should be like Amidon, you know, and we should stand unmoved. Yeah, it's like, well, Amidon had Van, right? And Adam and Eve, you know, they still have Van and everyone else, but they know that not forever. The Melchizedek, eventually, they're all going to go away, and it's just going to be the two of them all alone, right?
You know. I wonder if the material sons and daughters who have more on Gerasim have more of a three-brain type, if they're more three-brain type beings. And when they get rematerialized here, they have to be two-brain.
Yeah.
And that would perhaps make this stark separation even more stark.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a possibility. See, as you can speculate, yeah. But one way or another, you can see it. Just it boils down to you have to have this fullness of internalized wisdom. Right? You know, if it's not in you, then you're not going to have what it takes. Right? Remember how carefully they picked Van and the other nine, you know, that were with Van for that. You know, they're the ones that had all of that wisdom internalized, and they could stand against anything as an individual with no one else helping them. Right? You know, it could be 100% rebellion except for one person, Van, right? But Van had, the Most High has picked Van to be someone who could stand all by himself like that. You know, there could be someone in an ascending mortal to pick like that. But is it possible to even pick a material son and daughter like that? Have any of them ever been able to go through enough hard knocks, enough tribulation to get that much wisdom? Right? Are they just fundamentally dependent upon the planetary prince on any world?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, there's no way for them to, in all this preparation on Jerusalem, there's no way for them to experience being unplugged, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they can't. There's no possible way to prepare them for that experientially.
Yeah, yeah. It's
the
just
contrast is huge.
Right.
So that it induces pain.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine there where, there's sort of an infinite amount of input effectively, and you have to learn how to kind of, sort of filter it and, to go from everything to dead silence. Yeah.
That's kind of interesting because, we are so painfully unaware of our planetary isolation, that we think we're the only planet in the universe. So, I mean, it just, to me, it's kind of encouraging in the way that, gosh, it's going to be so much, better, so to speak, than it is here, and this is all we know.
Right. We're agendonters. We're agendonters. Adam and Eve are not.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't then. They are now. but they weren't then. You know?
It's kind of interesting, though.
Yeah. Yeah. See, and it's just like, well, but you still should be wondering, well, Chris, are you running too far? Okay, well, they throw in one other little paragraph here. What do they say?
Thus ended the first day of Adam and Eve on isolated Urantia, the confused planet of the Caligastia betrayal. And they walked and talked far into the night, their first night on Earth. And it was so lonely.
And it was so lonely, see. that's obviously it, see. That they doubled down on that. And you'll
see. They had each other to talk
Right. See, but, and then, and everything was okay as long as they.
Had each other.
Yeah, but as soon as they let, the separation happened, then, okay.
Sitting
ducks. Yeah. Divide and conquer. Okay, and you'll see here in this next paragraph, it brings it all to the use of a word that leaves no doubt.
Adam's second day on Earth was spent in session with the planetary receivers and the advisory council. From the Melchizedeks and their associates, Adam and Eve learned more about the details of the Caligastia rebellion and the result of that upheaval upon the world's progress. And it was, on the whole, a disheartening story, this long recital of the mismanagement of world affairs. They learned all the facts regarding the utter collapse of the Caligastia scheme for accelerating the process of social evolution. They also arrived at a full realization of the folly of attempting to achieve planetary advancement independently of the divine plan of progression. And thus ended a sad but enlightening day. They're second on your engine.
Okay, well, they're getting more kind of in the trenches education like they did on high. And they even say it was enlightening. All this. But look at the word that slipped in there. Did you see it? Disheartening.
Yeah.
Sad.
Right, disheartening. That's the key word. Right, that you can visualize directly in the hourglass analogy, right? The upper domain in the hourglass analogy. Right? They have a mind that you can analogize like that very much, just like ours. Right? The upper domain, that's where there's light. Disheartening, apart from the heart. Right? That's the lower domain.
Yeah.
darkness.
Yeah.
Right? It's all, the material gravity is just too much. It's pulling them down out of the light. Right? The light becomes separated. Right? There it is right there. Right? You know, that normally all of the, you know, the connectivity kind of helped them to kind of stay buoyant, you know.
Yeah.
No, you cut that all off and material gravity just got a hold of them and pulled them right down.
They're like, what have we gotten ourselves into?
They should have heard the story on high.
Yeah, but now they're hearing it firsthand, right, yeah. You know, and all this. And
nothing could prepare us.
Yeah.
Because we're seeing and say, oh, my gosh.
See again, it's like I'm pointing out, there's, you know, it all ends up, it's all this intellectual stuff is fine, okay, but right, it's that core thing. You have to keep your feet planted in the cosmos. Right? Material gravity rotated them around, and their feet are planted in the fear of the material foundation. Right? The painfully aware, the anguish, right down there on the first level of meaning, see? There it is right there. They lost that fundamental, you know, indelible connection within. And there was darkness where there wasn't before. And that just, the fact they tell you that it was disheartening right there means it's just a matter of time.
Right? Yeah.
At some point, right, the mustard seed will grow. You know, and it's going to not be a mustard seed of light, it's a mustard seed of darkness. Right? It's not the darkness of rebellion, right? But it gets dark enough that they get confused.
Yeah.
Right?
So from the standpoint of the observers looking at their mind, you know, that must have translated to, oh, they're not taking this well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's one thing to be lonely, but so lonely. So you can just feel the material gravity pulling them down when they say that. And the weight just pulls them down. Just real quick, when they, you know, they're not only meeting with the receivers, but this whole advisory council, you know, just to remind you, you know, back there post-rebellion when they were setting up things with Van and crew, you know, they said associated with the Melchizedek receivers was an advisory council consisting of one of the loyal aides of the fallen prince, the two resident life carriers, a trinitized son in apprenticeship training, a volunteer teacher's son, a brilliant evening star of Avalon periodically, the chiefs of Seraphim and Cherubim, advisors from two neighboring planets, the Director General of Subordinate Angelic Life. Oh, yeah, remember that's the Lesser Angels. And Van. Okay, that's the Advisory Council. All right, so they got all of that. I mean, a Trinity teacher's son.
Yeah.
Okay. And a brilliant evening star to, you know, for an interface and all of that. I mean, even neighboring planet. Okay. Right, see, so, but see, again, all that, it doesn't matter how much external stuff you have if you sink inside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? You can't sink inside. Yeah, right? I mean, again, there's a lot more help waiting for you on the first mansion world, but people go to iniquity on the first mansion world. Not because it's anything is sunken outside, it's because the individual sinks inside.
I experienced something akin to this when I went to Africa.
Uh-huh.
Because I just have a habit of seeing progress, even though it may not be apparent to most people. I see little hopeful signs of progress.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Ghana, it's those signs were missing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt myself, it's like trying to uphold an illusion.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't being supported by the facts. And it does. Feel pulled down by them.
Yeah. See, so, that other sense of disillusion, it's one thing to be literally apart from an illusion. But is it more than that? Is it apart from your hold of ideals? Right? Are you having a hard time keeping sight of ideals? The light at the end of the long tunnel, you know, if you lose that light, right, it all just goes dark. Right? And you can just visualize that tunnel is the neck of the hourglass, right? And the light is up in the upper domain. And just, you know, as you pull down, right, it just fades into the distance and you lose all hope. And, you know. All right. Let's keep going here.
The third day was devoted to an inspection of the garden. From the large passenger birds, the Fandors, Adam and Eve looked down upon the vast stretches of the garden while being carried through the air over this, the most beautiful spot on earth. This day of inspection ended with an enormous banquet in honor of all who had labored to create this garden of Edenic beauty and grandeur. And again, late into the night of their third day, the son and his mate walked in the garden and talked about the immensity of their problems.
The immensity. It's like, one step at a time. See, they immediately lose sight, you know, the big picture, and it just becomes this vast, overwhelming ocean of darkness, you know, flooding upon them. Right? They can't maintain their objectivity. Yeah. Right? It just becomes this sad tale. All this wonderful, cool stuff flying on Fandors and all this groovy stuff. You know? Yeah, but inside, see, it's really a sad story right from the beginning. When you use your insight to see inside of them and not just, you know, look at the glorious surroundings that are reflecting off the outside of them.
They're ripped from their moorings.
It's
like really stark.
Okay.
On the fourth day, Adam and Eve addressed the garden assembly. From the inaugural mount, they spoke to the people concerning their plans for the rehabilitation of the world and outlined the methods whereby they would seek to redeem the social culture of Urantia from the low levels to which it had fallen as a result of sin and rebellion. This was a great day, and it closed with a feast for the council of men and women who had been selected to assume responsibilities in the new administration of world affairs. Take note, women as well as men were in this group, and that was the first time such a thing had occurred on Earth since the days of Dalmatia. It was an astounding innovation to behold Eve, a woman, sharing the honors and responsibilities of world affairs with a man. And thus ended the fourth day on earth.
You know, they throw in that last part about, you know, men and women working together. Just to challenge you, they know you're going to be very excited by that, right? And it again, well, everything appears to be fantastic. See? They even kind of threw you some spiritual candy, sort of, as it were there, right? With that. You know, and oh, it's a great feast, and there's all these people who've selected to assume responsibilities, and right on the outside, it all looks glorious. Right? But you know, inside, right, they're feeling empty, you know, and so lonely, right, in the midst of all these people. Right? So
the close in circle that they have with Dan and Aodon and the rest of that. You think there's any download for them about, you know, how ripped apart they are? Or are they just keeping up appearances?
I don't know, right? I mean, again, you're left to kind of just speculate. But, you know, like I said, when all is said and done, it doesn't matter how much someone might be trying to help them or whatnot. I mean, you're sovereign inside, right? And right, and you're going to be the final say.
Yeah.
You can have all the king's horses and all the king's men on the first mansion world, and you can still go to iniquity, right, if that's your will. Right? There's none so blind as those who will not see. You just can't let, you know, that subjective darkness, you know, be reinforced by your will unwittingly, so that you start to reestablish a dark illusion. You know, it'll appear darker than it really is. That's the immensity thing.
Yeah.
Right? See, it was already appearing darker than it really was to them. So that means it's gone beyond natural. It's an unnatural darkness. Right? Their will is starting to reinforce this negatively. Okay.
The fifth day was occupied with the organization of the temporary government. The administration, which was to function until the Melchizedek receivers should leave Urantia.
So the Melchizedek's obviously told them something, maybe not exactly how long, but they were going to be around for a while still. So, you know, they say, okay, well, we need to set up some sort of temporary, you know, organization here. We won't get to it tonight, but eventually they'll tell us exactly how long the Melchizedek receivers stay around. And who was it? Was it you? You know, where you're wondering, yeah, how long was it before the Melchizedek receivers could see the writing on the wall? And it's like, well, okay, it's time to just leave and let the chips fall. You got to wonder if they kind of knew when they left that, no one take any other job. We'll be back here shortly. I mean, yeah. You got to just wonder.
Yeah.
Anyway.
This is
going to
wrap up fast.
Yeah, keep on there.
The sixth day was devoted to an inspection of the numerous types of men and animals. Along the walls eastward in Eden, Adam and Eve were escorted all day, viewing the animal life of the planet and arriving at a better understanding as to what must be done to bring order out of the confusion of a world inhabited by such a variety of living creatures.
That should catch you a little bit,
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's like, what? Wait a minute, they're looking at the animals and they're saying that they're arriving at a better understanding as to what must be done to bring order out of the confusion? I see. They're reminding you of just what experts Adam and Eve are. I mean, they can look at the animals. They know what kind of a human evolutionarily that will produce. They know exactly how those humans think. They could predict to 9 decimal places every thought that every human is going to have, like we talk about all the time. That's what's between the lines there. They're just reminding you of how, we're just an open book. Not because they're reading our minds, because they don't need to read our minds. They can predict everything we're going to think way in advance. We're just fancy machines. And you don't even have to look at us. You can look at the kind of animals are on the planet and calculate our thoughts.
That knowledge is not wisdom.
Right, that knowledge
is not wisdom.
Right, right.
The immensity of the problem.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
It's just the physics.
Yeah.
Makes you sound like the diversity was different than normal.
Yeah, I remember, it's this decimal world, so it's got all of this, diversity and
mosquitoes.
Flies. But just, between the lines there, that I try to get us to be humble about this all the time. I mean, there's so much that we think, oh, I'm exercising original free will. No. We have to be very humble about that. Just how much someone who really knows things could look at, what kind of reptiles we have on the planet and basically know exactly what you're thinking. I mean, it's just, we are so mechanical in so much that we do. And to just not be satisfied with anything that you think is originality, constantly challenging yourself to be more original than any originality you think you already have. Don't have any false illusions of success in originality. Okay.
It greatly surprised those who accompanied Adam on this trip to observe how fully he understood the nature and function of the thousands upon thousands of animals shown him. The instant he glanced at an animal, he would indicate its nature and behavior. Adam could give names descriptive of the origin, nature, and function of all material creatures on site. Those who conducted him on this tour of inspection did not know that the world's new ruler was one of the most expert anatomists of all Satania. and Eve was equally proficient. Adam amazed his associates by describing hosts of living things too small to be seen by human eyes.
Thousands upon thousands. I mean, it's just hard to believe
that. The menagerie that they had, seeing those walled, pens,
in Africa.
Obviously, you can see what I was just, stressing a minute ago about how much understanding they have. All he did is look at it, and he could describe its behavior. He didn't have to watch its behavior. He could just look at its nature and tell you exactly what its behavior is. Right? He can do the same thing. Yeah. So we're like that. Right? All they have to do, all your seraphim had to do is send your genetics. Once you were conceived, send that conceived genetics to Divinington. Right? And they can run a simulation for your adjuster, that's exactly the way you're going to think and do everything in your life, right?
To match you up with
the adjuster picks you not based on your beginning, but based upon the whole basic flavor of your life. The other thing that, if you're familiar with the Bible stories, do you remember how? In the second creation story, in the second chapter of Genesis, there's that spot about where God supposedly brings all the animals to Adam, and Adam gives them all names. See, part of the myth ties back to this, what he did there. See, everyone was so impressed by that. That little tidbit carried forward all those thousands of years and made it into the story, in its basic essence. Yep. Okay.
When the sixth day of their sojourn on earth was over, Adam and Eve rested for the first time in their new home in the east of Eden. The first 6 days of the ranch adventure had been very busy, and they looked forward with great pleasure to an entire day of freedom from all activities.
And of course, the day of rest thing is right there, just like in the Bible.
Right away, we're waiting for the weekend.
Everybody's working for the weekend, as the song goes. But.
But circumstances dictated otherwise. The experience of the day just passed, in which Adam had so intelligently and so exhaustively discussed the animal life of Urantia, together with his masterly inaugural address and his charming manner, had so won the hearts and overcome the intellects of the garden dwellers that they were not only wholeheartedly disposed to accept the newly arrived son and daughter of Gerasim as rulers, but the majority were about ready to fall down and worship them as gods.
See, like I said, it's no wonder that little tidbit made it into the end of the story. I mean, that was one of the things. Is like, okay, that's it. They're gods, all right? I mean, so it wasn't forgotten, told all those millennia later. So that's where we'll stop here. Is the best laid plans of mice and men for the day of rest got blown up by let us worship them. Remember, we all as they tell us, we all have this built into us genetically to be designed to accept them, like they pointed out there, right? Disposed to accept the newly arrived son and daughter of Gerasim. But that if you let any spiritual energy into that, it's going to quickly race off. And right, so we always have all these people that are effectively, we're identifying to genetically as Adam and Eve, that we exalt into effectively gods, lowercase g gods, they're ideological gods.
I guess I didn't anticipate this kind of, they're just about to worship us, just from what they knew about the Mendel type.
It's like, it's getting so heavy inside, they're actually kind of losing sight of what's going on around them. See, already by the end of the week, you know, all they can think about is just going off and and lounging, you know, apart, you know, the two of them. See, again, see, it's this self. There's a self-centeredness that's growing already, right? Isn't that amazing? See how quickly, see, material gravity drags you down, and then all the pathologies, you know, of a self-centered nature begin to play out inescapably. You can't do anything else. And so they start doing it. It's like all they can think about is putting their feet up, you know. Yeah, you know, when does the whistle blow here? You know, I'm done for the day. Already losing sight of what was brewing all around them. Yeah. So I hope you kind of, you know, see as I play through that, you know, we didn't so much focus on the immediacy of what they're talking about. It's what's underlying, right? That's really interesting and makes it so poignant.
We almost feel sorry for
him. Yes, see, yeah, you should, and you should recognize how. Yeah, I could do the same thing, and I need to be aware of that. It's going to sneak up on me if I don't constantly keep an eye out for this. So, anyway, so as you see, next time we have. At the end of the week, we have our first upheaval. That's where we'll pick up next time.
A loin-girding moment.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, Adam and Eve are going to respond, you know, with some positiveness, but you know, we've already kind of just seen it all is kind of a yada yada yada, you know, of what goes on in the outer life after this point. You know, the seeds are already sown inside. So, all right, let's take a moment here.